Iraq, Paul Bremer, who was the American administrator of the country, did so many mistakes by, again, dismantling the army, talking about de-Ba'athification, not allowing a lot of Iraqis to express themselves, to be part of a common project. I clearly remember that all Iraqis, Sunnis or Shia, Christian or Muslim, wanted to be part of something, wanted to be part of a common project. But the system brought by the U.S. Mindset at that time were completely against that. And this is something that needs to be highlighted today if you want to understand how Iraq is divided today.
Speaking of that division, I'd like to go back to 2006, when then-Senator Joe Biden co-authored a New York Times opinion piece headlined Unity Through Autonomy in Iraq. In the piece, he called for what's been termed a soft partition of Iraq, calling for the establishment of, quote, three largely autonomous regions with a viable central government in Baghdad. The Kurdish, Sunni, and Shiite regions would each be responsible for their own domestic laws, administration, and internal security. Baghdad would become a federal zone, while densely populated areas of mixed populations would receive both multi-sectarian and international police protection. Sinan Antoun, can you respond?
I mean, I remember that, and I actually wrote a response to that. It's vintage colonial vision and attitude. Mr. Biden from Delaware co-writes a piece telling Iraqis how their country should be. And at the time, I mean, despite the corruption and the sectarian sentiments of so many Iraqi politicians, they were vying and they were in conflict and they were even fighting. But none of them had asked for this type of division, actually, except for the Kurds, but that's a separate issue. But that these ideas were internalized then by a lot of Iraqi politicians to start calling for a separate zone for this and that. And of course, it would be only an excuse for even more organized corruption and more siphoning of Iraq's resources. But I should say that something that I've been thinking about and talking about is, you know, the epistemic violence of American occupation of Iraq, which is what my friend Furat, who's a talented writer that I admire, and I'm happy to be with him on the show, is this destruction and the erosion of an idea of what is to be Iraqi. Of course, every national identity is a composite, and there are always vying narratives. But what 2003 did is it's really tried to dismantle the idea of Iraqi nationalism and replace it with all of these other identities. And thankfully, the 2019 uprising by Iraqi youth, men and women, who went out on the street was actually the most vociferous, eloquent rejection of the regime that the United States installed. And it was a rejection of everything it stood for, and it showed that it had failed in every respect. It had failed in providing living, dignified conditions for Iraqi citizens despite all the wealth. And one of the early slogans of that uprising was no to Iran, no to the U.S., because one of the consequences of the U.S. invasion is the disproportionate influence that the Iranian regime has in Iraq through its militias, supporting the Iraqi militias and others. And the other thing is that what the U.S. invasion did to Iraqi sovereignty, you know, we have U.S. troops, of course, in Iraq. Turkey has troops in northern Iraq and Kurdistan and bombs whenever it feels like it. We have massive Iranian influence. And a lot of these U.S. journalists and so-called pundits and experts keep complaining about that. And I remember in the first few weeks of the invasion, there was a news item saying that the Badr Brigades, this is the militia of the, at the time it was called the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which later changed its name, which was based in Tehran, of course, because they were exiled and fought by Saddam Hussein. But the Badr militia came into Iraq, 30,000 armed men, and were allowed to enter into Iraq. And as Furat mentioned, of course, these people went on rampage, assassinating and killing and exerting vengeance. So the other issue was to completely dismantle the state institutions in Iraq and not replace them with functioning institutions. So you disband the army, but never really build a functioning army. And that's why when ISIS comes about, which is itself a product of American presence and occupation in Iraq, it was hatched in the U.S. military prisons. When ISIS comes about, there is no army to actually fight ISIS because of all of the corruption. And let's remember, who are the people who were sent to be experts to help rebuild the Iraqi army or the Iraqi police? I forgot his name, but the New York City police chief, who is himself corrupt, was sent to Iraq to supposedly help build the army. Exactly. And
who himself was jailed in the Bernard Kerik Detention Center in Lower Manhattan. They took away the name Bernard Kerik once he was jailed there.
Yes, and your viewers should go and look at also how many people who planned and called for the war then went into Iraq as contractors. This was so the elite and those who supported the war did not lose anything. Their, you know, their portfolios tripled, their investments went up and all of that. And of course, it's average citizens who paid the price. But
Sinan, I wanted to follow up on something that you said earlier, and that was when the after the 9/11 attacks, President Bush immediately started pushing to attack Iraq. And as you said, many people don't realize, understand it, that, I mean, 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. A day or two after the attacks, you had President Bush on the Truman balcony with the man they called Bandar Bush, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, smoking cigars together. Right at that time, we interviewed soon after Richard Clark, the counterterrorism czar, who said that the day after 9/11, President Bush questioned him and other associates of the White House to see if Saddam Hussein did this, see if he's linked in any way. Clark was incredulous. He said in his book, Against All Odds, but Mr. President, Al-Qaeda did this. He said, Bush responded, I know, but see if Saddam was involved. Just look, I want to know any shred. Clark added later that he felt they were being intimidated to find a link between the 9/11 attacks and Iraq. And when the attack on Iraq came in 2003, you had the leading Democrats, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, as students were being dragged out of her office in New York. She was senator at the time. She voted for the war in Iraq. Talk about the consensus at that point. There wasn't a consensus on the ground, but the media was building this consensus for war.
Well, no, that's a very important point. And I think, you know, there was a convergence of different waves and factions. Of course, we know that from the early 90s, the group of neocons had already started this notion of changing the regime in Iraq. Of course, not for the benefit of the Iraqis or for any concerns for liberty or freedom, but for geopolitical interest and protecting the interests of Israel and thinking of U.S. hegemony. And then it converges with Bush's messianic vision. Let's remember, I mean, those of us who are old enough remember, but I think younger viewers should realize and should read about the type of messianic, insane vision that Bush thought that he was, you know, that he had a mandate from God. And then there is the, you know, the lingering issue of his father and the supposed assassination attempt. But exactly right away after 9/11, both Bush and Rumsfeld were into, you know, let's go and attack Iraq. So the evidence was manufactured later, and it was very weak and flimsy evidence. So when so many, until now, are saying, had we known back then what we know, actually, everything was obvious. Those of us who managed to read or who did not have the ideological leaning, it was obvious that there were no weapons of mass destruction and no link with Al-Qaeda. So the question for U.S. citizens and for others is, why is it that there was a consensus? And I think it's this colonial mentality and, frankly, white supremacy that is internalized by so many. And I mentioned in the article that this term that the U.S. Army uses in Iraq and Afghanistan, Indian country. I mean, in the first few months, I was watching TV and I saw an embedded journalist. We have to also think not only of embedded journalists, embedded scholars, even embedded artists. the view in mainstream U.S. culture is so skewed that a film that is actually pro-war, like The Hurt Locker, is considered an anti-war film. But the embedded journalist was with a group of U.S. soldiers in a Humvee about to exit a military base that the U.S. had occupied to go into somewhere near Baghdad. And the soldier tells the journalist, we are now in Indian country. And that stayed with me, and I looked into it. And what does it mean? I mean, when Indian country, meaning, you know, lawless land where there are no laws and no civilization. And that, you know, simultaneously, of course, invokes the national U.S. myth about spreading civilization on this continent and erases genocide and destruction, but also it convinces the soldiers and the viewers that actually they are spreading democracy and civilization. And it extends to everyone. A lot of journalists until today and many years into the war would ask, so did we not do something good in Iraq? So where does this assumption that somehow, if the U.S. Army goes somewhere, they must do something good? And it's a complete denial of the colonialism that is ingrained in this view of looking at the world and looking at other parts of the world.
Sinan Antoun, we're going to continue this discussion after break. Iraqi poet and author, professor at New York University, and Fouad Alani, French-Iraqi journalist. We will also hear from Sinan a poem he will read, and for Fouad to talk about what happened in his city of Fallujah. This conversation as President Putin is indicted for war crimes by the International Criminal Court, we're looking back 20 years ago today when President Bush invaded Iraq. Stay with us. Iraqi-Canadian musician Nova Imad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our guests for this hour on this 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq are two Iraqis, Sinan Antoun, Iraqi poet and author, professor at New York University, and Fouad Alani, the French-Iraqi journalist whose family is from Fallujah. Nermeen?
Your documentary titled Flavors of Iraq, we'll just go to a clip now, in which your character visits the Green Zone in 2011, just before the U.S. troop withdrawal, and your character tells American soldiers there what he thinks of the invasion. Let's go to a clip.
I told them that freedom can't be forced on people. That they had empowered 1,000 dictators by trying to shoot one. That they had destroyed a country on the basis of a lie.
In the world.
That they had started a war between armed groups supported by foreign powers. That they had done more bad than good. And today, the country was in pieces.
We had nothing to do here.
They had nothing to do here. The Iraq that I dreamed of as a child. The Iraq that my father fled but loved so much. The Iraq split by the Euphrates River, which I take my name from. That Iraq no longer existed.
a clip from your documentary, Flavors of Iraq. If you could talk about that documentary and that section, the clip that we just played.
Farhat.
Thank you. Well, the aim of this documentary is, again, to go against this binary vision of Iraq. And that's why I struggled during all my career as a journalist to give a subjective view about the Iraq I know and the Iraq I've seen. And the first city I've seen along with Baghdad was Fallujah. Fallujah was not a well-known city before the war. It was just, it still is 50 kilometers west of Baghdad. It was a remote area, very green, along the Euphrates River, which is my name. Farhat is the Euphrates River, because my father used to live around, to play around this river and had good memories. Have you heard anywhere talking about Iraq in a beautiful way? It's very difficult today. I challenge anyone to look for any beautiful picture or image of Iraq. And my aim with this documentary is to remind that Fallujah was a peaceful city again, and struggled like Baghdad around during the embargo that started in 91 until 2003. The idea, again, is to confront a concept that completely disappeared when the U.S. Invasion happened in Iraq. And the sequence that you just showed is about maybe the last moments of the U.S. troops occupying Iraq. And I was confronted to the young soldiers who still knew nothing about the country. And our discussion went around the idea that Iraq was more than Sunni and Shia, more than Ba'athist and militias. And I was really happy to give them some news about the Iraq I've seen. And I was amazed and surprised, how the U.S. soldiers knew nothing about the country. And still thought that Saddam had a link with Al-Qaeda and with the 9/11 attacks. The aim, again, 20 years later, is to describe a concept of Iraq that existed and hopefully, as Sinan Antoun mentioned, will exist again through this new generation of young people who protested since October 2019. Claiming Iraq, going against the idea that Iraq is between the U.S. and Iran. The first sentences in the street were around this type of phrases. We are all Iraqis. We want to get back our country. And this is the only hope I can see today after 20 years going back to Iraq and to cover the news there. The only hope among all the destruction, all the consequences on every level of the Iraqi society, the only hope is to see this youth claiming back what once was a country.
I wanted to go, Farhat Alami, to a clip of your 2012 documentary, Fallujah, A Lost Generation. In this, Dr. Hanna Ahmed of Fallujah Hospital examines a baby born with deformities. When you made the film, you said one in five babies born in Fallujah exhibited congenital malformations.
He needs an operation. At the moment, he's much too weak for us to move forward with surgery. So we have him on observation. We have seen many other types of deformities. He's not alone. Some are more severe than others. We have some babies born without skulls, without organs, and sometimes with their legs totally twisted.
Farhat, if you can talk specifically about your city, about Fallujah, the extent of the attack, the use, for example, by the United States, the illegal use of white phosphorus, the second battle of Fallujah in 2004.
Yes, and you mentioned that Fallujah is my parents' hometown. So I had a specific look at the city for personal reasons, also because Fallujah became sadly well known in the international communities. Fallujah was one of the first cities to resist the U.S. occupation and misbehavior and killings of Iraqi people. And when it started in 2003 until 2004, the first battle between residents of Fallujah and the U.S. Army was a political disaster for the U.S. administration. And then, to go briefly, they came back in November 2004 with the idea of erasing Fallujah from the map. And that's what happened. So when I came back to Fallujah after this second battle, I discovered a city that was effectively, actually, completely destroyed, erased. Around 90% of the houses were on the ground. I had the chance to talk to my uncles that stayed there and testified that the color in the sky changed, that a new kind of weapons were used. Testimonies about white phosphorus, about very heavy weapons destroying in an instant a house or a street. And we discovered later on that uranium was used. When I came back to do an investigation about some terrific and terrible news about babies born with deformities, the pictures were so terrible that I could not really look at them. And I spent 2 weeks there talking to the inhabitants in Fallujah, to the hospital doctors, going into data and talking to the families that were trying to hide those kids. We talked to a lot of scientists. We had studies. We had a lot of data linking the U.S. bombing of Fallujah and all the diseases and all the babies born with deformities. And you mentioned a figure that is still the case today. 1 in 5 babies are born with deformities in Fallujah. This is one of the most terrible consequences of the U.S. invasion. And still today, the city is struggling with this sanitary, if we can call this way, situation in Fallujah. And this is a catastrophe to me.
Sinan Antoun, you've written a poem that will appear in your book when it comes out in the summer, an English translation, a translation you've done yourself from the Arabic. If I could ask you, please, to read that poem, which is also about the use of white phosphorus and depleted uranium by the Americans in Iraq.
Sure. I mean, it was written years ago after the catastrophe that Furat was talking about came to light. And it's entitled Phosphorus. When I was a kid, the tail end of my bike had a red reflector. It glowed in the dark, like the eyes of a cat illuminated by the headlights of distant cars, tiny bits of phosphorus. Tiny bits of phosphorus, white phosphorus, illuminated the skies of Fallujah years ago, and now infants are born there every day with two heads or without eyes.
And thank you. That's a very moving and beautiful poem. Now, we're speaking as the Russian invasion of Ukraine has entered its second year. And we've just heard now that the International Criminal Court has called for the arrest of Putin as a war criminal. Now, the U.S. took many steps to ensure, has taken, that its own officials and military would be protected from any such attempts by the International Criminal Court or any other international body from facing such allegations. If you could respond to that. I mean, we've just been talking about the use of chemical weapons and the fact that no one has been charged with war crimes.
Well, I also want to go back to 1991. I didn't know.
No, Sinan Antoon, if you could please respond. Sinan.
You know, the depleted uranium was already used in 1991 and caused catastrophic consequences for Iraqi citizens, especially in Basra, for example, and the skyrocketing cancer rates. But also there were war crimes committed in 1991 in so-called Desert Storm. There are horrific images of how the U.S. bombed withdrawing Iraqi troops from Kuwait. It's called the Highway of Death. And there is only one American journalist who took those images. And I think there was most media outlets did not show them because they were too horrific. But, you know, there are double and triple standards in so-called international law. And as we can see, of course, the law is weaponized when it serves the interest, because by any measure, Bush, Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld are all war criminals. But, of course, they will not be put on trial. And I think, actually, Bush cannot travel internationally because he, you know, might face consequences. So, I mean, the attitudes, especially of Americans, but of a lot of Europeans, to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, in so many ways, just shows the double standards and the hierarchy of human worth that a lot of people on this planet believe in. Who really is a full human being that you can empathize with, you know, because they look like us, quote-unquote, or because they are European from a certain part of Europe also, and whose death really doesn't count, whether they're Palestinian or Yemeni or Syrian or Iraqi or Afghani, whose death doesn't even register. And the million deaths becomes just a statistic because they are not viewed as having lived full lives because their lives do not resemble our lives. So, you know, Putin is considered a war criminal, but we live in a country where war criminals are still going around, appearing on TV, dancing on the Ellis DeGeneres show. And, you know, Bush talks about his paintings. And also, when these war criminals die, as with Rumsfeld, there isn't even a mention of the catastrophic consequences of their decisions, that as we talk now about depleted uranium, this is in the unborn babies. This is in the wombs of mothers. This is in the air and in the soil, and it will always be there.
And let's put the same question to Fuad Alani. As President Putin has been indicted for war crimes, on this 20th anniversary of the Bush invasion, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, do you feel that President George W. Bush, that Dick Cheney, and other high-level U.S. government officials should be charged with war crimes for what happened to your country, to Iraq?
Yes, and as Sinan mentioned, the list of crimes is very long, especially about Iraq, but not only Iraq. It was funny to see the reaction of Joe Biden talking about the ICC going after Putin, when Joe Biden said something like, yes, this is great. But at the same time, he said, but us, the USA, we don't recognize the ICC. And we know why. Bush would be on the list. A lot of people would be on the list. Even if we can see similarities, of course, with the invasion of Ukraine by Putin and Iraq at that time, on the illegal aspect, on the aggression of international law.
We have 10 seconds.
It's very important to remind, that Bush should be judged. And it's not acceptable that he's still joking about Iraq.
Fuad Alani, French-Iraqi journalist, Sinan Antoon, Iraqi poet and author. We will link to your works. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia. broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples. Find us online at cjsf.ca and on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and SoundCloud.